Hi, I'm David Korn.
And I'm Jim Pinkerton.
And together,
we're Blogging Heads TV. Back again,
where our motto is, we're dead from the neck down. So don't worry about it. Fresh from today's headlines, we're talking first about what, Jim?
Well, I think that the big news, of course, is the prospect of another war in the Middle East, as if we didn't have enough already.
Yes, they're coming. They seem to be coming cheaper these days. The news, of course, we're talking about is the Turkish army shelling positions of Kurdish separatist rebels who have been becoming increasingly assertive and aggressive out of strongholds in Iraq.
Right. I mean, it's something like 40 Turkish citizens and soldiers have been killed in recent weeks on the Kurdish border. And I think back to 1916 when we sent General Pershing.
You were around back then?
For a lot less than this. Yeah. So I mean, it is a big deal contributing to the notion that some have that this is a little bit of a cluster, you know what, in Iraq.
Yeah, so unfortunately, it brings us back to one of our favorite features here on Blogging Heads TV. The I told you so. I mean, it was so predictable that the Kurds would take this opportunity to do what they've been doing for decades. And it's not just Turkey as well. Front page of the paper this week had a picture of a Kurdish brigade full of women, as it turned out, who are doing similar actions into Iran. And there's a whole question of whether the Kurdish rebel force that's focused on Iran as opposed to the one that's focused on Turkey is actually a terrorist outfit that we should be sanctioning rather than talking to, as it seems to be the U.S. government is doing. So it goes back to the fact that when it comes to playing the great game, as it's long been called, when foreign Western powers mingle in matters of Arabia and Persia, that it's quite complicated, and we usually mess things up more than we help.
Right. I mean, the essence of the great game is to have other troops fighting each other. And yes. So, for example...
Well, we've succeeded!
Oh, no, except
we got
case,
Turkey fighting the Kurds!
The Kurds are our one kind of poster boy ally. And I think that it's surprising to me. The Kurds have stipulating the Kurds have been horribly abused from history and gassed
right.
and murdered, massacred by the Turks, by the Arabs, by the Iranians. So they have a right to be mad at all of them.
And don't forget how they were set up by Henry Kissinger in the 70s, and then, they were betrayed by him when he changed sides. But that's a whole other story.
Right. That's a nation hobby horse that we can continue to ride. And not that you're wrong. But the Kurds should be playing a little smarter in terms of you can't attack everybody all the time and survive. That is kind of how minority groups become even more minority. But it's an unfortunate situation, and it does.
Well, they have their history, their culture, and it seems to be true that their belief now is that our time has come. And it's not just in terms of going after Iran and going after Turkey. We're going to, it still hasn't played out yet in Iraq. They have cooperated with the national government, but there still is fighting to be done, unfortunately, over who gets control, as they call it, the oil-rich city of Kirkuk.
I don't think they're even cooperating with the national government.
Well, they come to meetings once in a while.
Well, they come to meetings, but inside Kurdistan, they have their own. Yeah. By law, you cannot fly the Iraqi flag.
Right, right.
So, in other words, it is a case of we'll keep what we get and negotiate over what you have. Situation. In any case, it is remarkable to watch the Bush administration say, oh, everything's under control, everything's calm. I was watching some hearing on C-SPAN earlier today, and they said, somebody was talking to Secretary Rice and said, now what are we going to do to preserve peace in Iraq? And yeah, if you weren't laughing, you'd be crying, because it's so sad.
Right. Well, one question I have is, there's been this movement afoot in the U.S. Senate, not in Congress, and on op-ed pages across the land to try to divide up Iraq into a loosely federated state with Kurdistan, Shiistan, and Sunnistan. And I'm wondering if these new developments, the fighting between Turks and Kurds and the Kurdish efforts against Iran, make that more likely, less likely?
It's hard to say. I mean, certainly Iraq is de facto devolving into three places. I mean, I think that's one of the
That's Peter Galbraith's argument. He is the former ambassador, I believe, to Bosnia, who's been working on the Kurdish issue for years. He has some business interests there as well, as he freely admits, and he's written a book, and he supports the Biden plan to divide things up. He's very pro-Kurdish and believes that whether we want this to be happening or not, it's happening.
Actually, I prefer to think of it as the Pinkerton plan, because I went...
Okay, there you go, Jim.
I wrote about this. I looked it up on July 10th, 2003. not that I'm keeping track or anything. But
well, in the grand tradition of the great game, it's not really your project unless we can come up with like the Pinkerton line, like 2 miles south of Kirkuk, whatever. There has to be a line, the Pinkerton line. So we'll send you out there with Mason and Dixon, yeah. And you can sort of
I think I'd rather do it from Google Maps than actually surveying it myself physically.
Yeah.
But in any case, I think what's really going to whatever happens in terms of the divisions in Iraq, whether those de facto divisions ever become de jure divisions,
yeah.
I think what's more likely than ever now is that sooner or later the American president, it may not be Bush, it may be whoever comes after Bush in terms of the presidency, is going to sort of throw up his or her hands and say, look, I give this to the United Nations,
right.
I give this to NATO, I give this to the Arab League, I give this to somebody. But I think that just the Hobbesian situation of all war of all against all is becoming so clear now that no single power has the patience and kind of.
I also think it is too vexing, even for the giant intellects in the White House, Dick Cheney and George Bush and Condi Rice. I mean, this is really hard stuff, and I think at some point. You just have to say, too much trouble for me. Let someone else take a swing at it.
Exactly. And the clock, meanwhile, is ticking away. We're down to 14 months now for this administration. So I think that...
I think if Bush could buy 3 months and get out 3 months sooner, he would. He doesn't say anything in the Constitution about not doing that, but I think he could. But while we're speaking about mighty intellects on the world stage, let's turn to the Republican presidential field.
Okay.
My question to you, as a person who used to work on Republican campaigns, and you worked for the first George Bush president. And Ronald Reagan. Is there anything redeemable about the current GOP presidential field? A quick rundown. Mitt Romney, a total flip-flopper, far more so than John Kerry ever was, if he was. And, he said things like a couple weeks ago at one of the debates, he said, we wouldn't have this mess in Iraq if Saddam Hussein had let in the IAEA nuclear weapons inspectors. Well, what was he not reading the newspapers in 2002, 2003? They were in there. They were finding there were no nuclear weapons. This guy doesn't deserve to be president. Giuliani, talking about this great game, mess of a game in Mesopotamia, he keeps saying, we need a strategy for Iraq. I have a strategy for Iraq. My strategy is victory. Can you take that seriously? John McCain, he's tired, he's lost his maverick sex appeal. Fred Thompson, he's actually a global warming denier. Not even George Bush denies global warming's happening, he just doesn't want to do anything about it. But Fred Thompson is denying that it's a problem. He did so in a radio commentary just a few months ago. So is this the best the Republican Party has to offer? None of these guys have come up with any ideas or solutions to the problems that ail us these days.
Well, you only mentioned three of them. Are you done?
Four. I mentioned four. Oh. If you want to go on down the line,
okay.
and hail Mike Huckabee,
well,
go ahead.
I would say, first of all, the only reason, or a major reason for even you to be spending a lot of time thinking about these Republican candidates is because I think, more and more, frankly, it's likely that one of them is going to wind up as the next president. They're going to beat Hillary or whoever the Democrats run.
Bold prediction from Jim Pinkerton.
I'm sensing that for reasons we'll come to in a moment. But just to review the field here for a second, I certainly agree on McCain as a burnout candle. I think that Romney, the best you can say for him is that after 8 years of moral clarity, we could use a little flip-flopping, a little constructive, somersaulting on issues.
I wouldn't mind if he just sort of fessed up to it. I mean, that's the thing.
Well, okay. I mean, but you know what they said about Franklin Roosevelt, a chameleon on plaid. I mean, so this is not the first time that somebody has, you know, has changed. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt campaigned in 1932 on balancing the budget.
I encourage you to go out there and start the flip-floppers for Romney pack. 527.
Fred Thompson, I realized that nobody had a better run of press 6 months ago, and nobody's had a worse 6 months than him since then. In terms of just Saturday Night Live and everybody making fun of them.
Larry Craig had a bad stretch of it, but not...
Okay, fair enough. Nobody in the presidential race. Okay, right.
Yeah.
But I would say this, that if Thompson can get his campaign act together, I think he'll still be pretty formidable because he speaks to the base of the Republican Party, which is, you know, and the Republican Party, I think, is the natural majority party in the country. So if he simply has to sort of get to the point where he's kind of like, if you will, in a Woody Allen sense, showing up. And I think that just recently I was reading in the Washington Times, which is a newspaper that is very much read among the conservative activist community, either
maybe only read by the
that's entirely possible.
Yes.
But among conservative activists, the kind of people who go to primaries. Thompson saying in the paper this morning that he would deny federal aid to states and localities that harbor illegal aliens. That may, be vexatious to Victor Novasky, but it is catnip to, rank and file Republicans out there in the base. And then, of course, there's Mike Huckabee, who...
Wait a second. Before you get to Huckabee, you got to finish with the front of the Packers. Rudy Giuliani.
Giuliani, the thing you got to say about him, it's just a fact, is that he runs pretty competitively with Hillary in the national polls.
In the last poll, she actually beat him, but
she beat him by like 3 points.
Yes.
But that's for considering the fact that Bush is down to as low as 24 approval in some of these polls. I mean, 24. When your president's at Nixon levels like that, the idea that you're even competitive in the race at all and not just completely getting annihilated is kind of an achievement.
Well, my question is, if a Republican candidate runs next year in the general election saying my strategy for winning in Iraq is victory, is the public going to go for that?
I think that if the Republican candidate says peace with honor, and that's...
Not about peace with honor. We're talking about peace with honor was a cover for a retreat and surrender. Back in the Nixon days.
No, it was not. It was because Nixon had no intention in November of 1972 of losing in Vietnam. It was Watergate that crippled him. If Nixon had stayed pre-president until 77, until January 20th,
wasn't he already negotiating by that point?
Of course, he was negotiating.
Okay, he was negotiating how to get out.
He was, and we in fact had gotten out. We were down to like 100,000 troops in Vietnam in 72. On election, but Nixon was perfectly prepared, as the Christmas bombing post-election 72 reminds us, to bomb the North Vietnamese forever.
And, for all the good it did.
Well, it did do good. It defeated the May 72 offensive when the North Vietnamese.
It killed a lot of innocent Vietnamese.
There's two different issues here. One is what Nixon was. Three issues. One is what Nixon intended to do. One is what Nixon did. And then the third one, of course, is the fate of civilians and the people of South Vietnam. Now, in terms of politics, what Nixon intended to do was not lose in Vietnam. And I think he would have, if he'd stayed as a strong, unimpeached, unscandal-ridden president, which, of course, he didn't, he would have kept a sufficient American military presence in there with the sort of perfected art of aerial bombardment. And not
perfected art? Come on.
Perfected in terms of ask the North Vietnamese if it was working against their army, and the answer is it was.
It wasn't defeating them. I mean, you can go read the Pentagon Papers, which actually precede that time, to be fair. But their argument was that aerial bombardment could never do the trick. Maybe it would keep you even for some point of time, but you couldn't win that way. But let's get away from historical what ifs.
I would say this: Giuliani is to me, in terms of personality. And so for all those people at News Hounds and Media Matters and wherever else who want to cut and paste these clips if they bother with Blogging Heads TV, I'm saying in terms of personality, in terms of political sort of agenda, I think Giuliani is the most like Nixon, a tough-minded moderate. And that's a pretty fearsome combination in American politics, to be a tough-minded moderate. Most moderates tend to be kind of woolly-headed and mushy as well as being centrist.
Yeah, who will do anything, whatever it takes to win.
Well,
fair
enough. I said tough-minded.
I still wonder, you know, to what degree, and we don't know yet, where the public's going to be in looking at the war and whether, you know, someone who comes along and says, I'm going to win it without a plan. I mean, you know, Rudy Giuliani has said nothing about what he would be doing differently at this point to win the war. He's just been saying, you know, he's been hiding behind Bush's dress, saying, I support the president and I want to win like the president does come next November. That's not going to be good enough because Bush will have not won the war by that point, in all probability, as I know you agree with me. And so the question is going to be, dear Rudy, or whoever the nominee is on the Republican side, what would you be doing differently come the time you take the office? And if you don't have anything to say about it, then I wonder if the public is going to, you know, buy your I'm going to win routine.
I agree with that. That's a good point. I agree with that, which is one should remember what Nixon did in 1971 and 72, which is...
Well, in 68, he said he had a secret plan to end the war.
And he did.
I'm talking about 68.
He did have a secret plan. And the plan was revealed pretty quickly, which was he was going to go around North Vietnam to China and Russia.
Right. This was a secret plan didn't end the war.
It ended American participation and by about...
I thought you just said it was ended by Watergate.
It ended... substantial American military participation by election day 72.
Well, you know what? I think we're both too young to be arguing about Vietnam.
In a way, because the point is he went to Russia and China. So that what the next president, if the next president wants to fix Iraq and also Iran, then he or she is going to have to somehow break Iran's current alliance with Russia and China, which we saw visibly when Putin visited Tehran last week. And the Chinese and also now the Indians are busy buying up Iranian oil and natural gas.
I'm going to be happy to watch Rudy Giuliani get out there and say, I'm going to end this war by forging close relations with Russia and China and forcing them to do what we want them to do. But let's move on if we can, because we've got a fun packed show here, full of thrills and chills. Driver's license in New York State. Become an issue, something that you care about. Care to explain?
Well, I mean,
why do you care about who's getting a driver's license in the
Governor Spitzer
Empire State
of New York? Had a plan, issued a plan.
Governor Elliott Spitzer, very popular Democrat, tough-minded moderate. Right?
Well, that's what he campaigned on.
Yeah.
You can always win like that, but you got to remember to govern like that.
Okay.
And Governor Spitzer, who previously used his toughness to try and clobber his Republican opponent and antagonist, Joe Bruno, in what seems to be kind of a scandalous situation where he was sicking the New York authorities on his rival, the Republican State Senate Majority Leader, Bruno, had a new idea, which was he ordered the Department of Motor Vehicles in all the counties of New York to issue driver's licenses to anybody regardless of their citizenship status. And this has caused an uproar in New York State, a liberal state that John Kerry carried enormously, that Spitzer won by a 2-1 margin.
Now, are you saying Spitzer just gone crazy, or is there some policy reason to do this?
Well, there's lots of policy reasons in terms of what you can argue this, but the politics are crazy, and I can prove it.
No. Before we get to politics, let's talk about politics, the policy. Because, you know, would you also say that Spitzer should put an order out saying that that people should not be treated at hospitals or clinics unless they can prove their status? That anytime a cop pulls over anybody, he should ask their status. Anytime he questions a eyewitness to a crime, he should ask their status. I mean, is this, you know, should we become a police force, a state police force, a national police force, that makes status the be-all and end-all?
Well, to be honest, I think we should.
Okay.
I support, obviously, somebody wounded or injured, they come to an emergency room, obviously you treat them.
And what about public schools?
First and foremost.
What about public schools? Should we kick those kids out?
I probably would move toward a policy of either going back to the feds and saying, listen, we can't have illegal aliens in our country like this. And if we have to deport them, we will. If you're not a citizen, you don't have a right to be here.
Local police forces now have to go into the local schools and do the deporting themselves.
We have to move in that direction. But
we have 12 million people here.
What needs to happen is the feds need to step in and make this a matter of national policy. And that's what George W. Bush, who basically sides with the Democrats on this issue, has resolutely refused to do. And
well, what he's done is in this in one, I think the one instance I can think of, he's actually bowed to reality. The notion that you can go around and tear 12 million people out of the fabric of the society and ship them all back somewhere, it seems to me absurd. And if you can't really do it, then you got to come up with another policy.
Well,
otherwise, you get all these, you know, all these situations where you'll be, you know, deporting parents but leaving children behind because they were born here. And who does this deporting? Do you want to create, Jim, a supersized, you know, it's not INS anymore, ICE, and, you know, spend $50 billion dollars now and get a police force of 500,000, 1 million INS agents, ICE agents, to go and do this?
Well, the first thing that one would do, and Governor Spitzer was free to do this and he chose not to, was to demand greater federal enforcement. The feds right now are doing exactly that. They are raiding workplaces, finally, and deporting people, and obviously in the course of doing so, sometimes tearing up families. It's unfortunate. The real answer,
but you
of course,
know that's tokenism.
Is to keep them from coming here in the first place.
Right. Well, those are the two issues that, you know, that have been at odds with each other. One is what you do to prevent increase in the population of illegal, undocumented people here. And the other is what you do with those who are here already, particularly those who have been here for a while and have become part of the fabric of our society. I mean, what seemed to me what Bush, you know, tried to do with Democratic help, and John McCain, to be fair to John McCain, was very much involved in this, was try to, you know, do everything at once, end up sort of doing everything at once not so well, and therefore peeved every different part of the constituencies out there.
Right. So let's talk about the politics of this, which have been catastrophic for the open borders people. First of all, the immigration bill was defeated last June. And now Governor Spitzer, who sort of acts as if that immigration bill was not defeated, as if the policy was the only thing that mattered, put forth a policy that has split the Democratic Party in New York in half, that the New York State Senate voted 39-19. That's more than 2-1, including
right.
8 Democrats, which is a quarter of the Democratic caucus up
right.
there, or more than a quarter, to reject the Spitzer plan. And
right.
a poll shows that 73% of New Yorkers oppose Spitzer's plan. So in other words, the right. politics, whatever the policy merits, and again, I see a sharp distinction as you know, between the building a wall along the southern border, which I'm 100% for,
sure.
to the issue of deportation and, as you say, tearing up the fabric, which I'm much more mixed about and much more would do it on a case-by-case basis. But because the elites who mm-hmm. have been completely wedded, Democrat and Republican, to open borders and various kind of schemes of guest workers and so on, which they agree to the credit of the left, opposed, but by
right.
and large, most liberal mainstream Democrats, including Teddy Kennedy, have supported a guest worker program.
Well, yeah, that was an argument. There are a lot of liberals who don't like the guest worker
right.
program because
that
it creates a two-tier system with workers
right.
who don't have the rights to organize and protest.
Like you, I oppose the
yeah.
guest worker program,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's the credit of both of us. But the point is, meanwhile, the politics of immigration are changing dramatically. There's an article on the front page of the Washington Post Metro section today about a poll in Virginia, which has kind of become a purple state in the last little bit. You know, the Democrats have won the
yeah.
governorship
yeah.
two straight elections.
They're likely to win the Senate race up next
possible.
Year.
It's entirely possible. It's the only thing that will keep that from happening is if Mark Warner is dumb enough, the Democratic nominee for the Senate up here down in here in Virginia or there yeah. in Virginia. If he's dumb enough to embrace this policy of Spitzer, if he takes the policy of, say, Jim Webb, who will be the senior senator from New York, who was elected
from Virginia,
year, then he might be fine. But I'm telling you right now, if Mark Warner tries to run on the Spitzer program, the Republicans nominate.
He's clearly, listen, that's a state issue. He's clearly not going to run for the U.S. Senate, talking about driver's licenses in the state of Virginia.
If the Washington Post has a poll showing that 75% of Virginians...
I'm sure Republicans are going to try to make this...
75% is a big number,
to be
David.
An issue. I understand it's a big an issue. The question also is, you know, if you ask me about this, you know how polling works, Jim. If it's not, the issue isn't what people say to an individual poll. The issue is what they actually care about when you don't ask them. when they don't ask them, and it's quite clear, you know, from reading, listening to talk radio and so on, there is a slice of this country that is obsessed, I would think sometimes to the point of unhealthy obsession, with the issue of immigration and illegal immigration. And they are very vocal, and they have a lot of access to the airwaves. And I think a lot of other people are more divided and have more nuanced and more split views. And if you ask them the question, should illegal aliens get driver's licenses? Well, I think a lot of people are going to say no to that. But if you say, you know, would you vote against somebody because they don't want to throw people out of this country? Well, you might get a different answer. So it works both ways. I mean, you know, if the people out there are beating the drum on driver's licenses, also beating the drum to round up 12 million people and ship them back across the border, well, then the political advantage isn't as clear as you're making it out to be.
I agree with you. But of course, the politics are such that the presumption now is that if Teddy Kennedy and John McCain and Lindsey Graham and George W. Bush can't get an immigration bill through, can't legalize the status of it, then obviously the politics are extremely uphill for those who want to legalize. And of course, the bigger test comes is what happens when somebody says, like say Hillary Clinton, I want to have a national health care plan. So now we go from, do you get health care when you go to an emergency room, you know, which happens tragically and unfortunately once every so often, to
a
standard plan where everybody who abides in this country gets, say, $5,000 or $10,000 worth of guaranteed health care coverage a year. How do you think that's going to play with...
Well, from a policy perspective, it may be cheaper in the long run, of course. You know the reasons why.
I'm sorry, what's that?
It may be cheaper in the long run.
To what?
You know, to have people get medical attention that's not in emergency rooms.
Do you think that anything close to a majority of the American people will support health care for people who aren't here legally?
Probably not.
Okay.
You know,
well,
but the question is again whether that's whether that becomes the driving issue or not. I have no doubt there are people who are going to try to make it the driving issue and try to make this as demagogic as possible. I'm not accusing you, of course, of doing that because you're a gentleman and a scholar.
Well, I think the real lesson is what's going on in Europe. In Europe, the Europeans, of course, are confronted with immigration issues of their own.
Of course.
And they're confronted with the challenge to the welfare state of illegal immigration and so on. Over and over again in Europe, they're choosing to keep the welfare state and to change their immigration laws. It's happening in Britain. It's happening in France. It's happening in Italy. It just happened in Switzerland.
Right. And I, you know, with globalization and the rush to the bottom, there are more pressures on these individual previously homogeneous societies and economies than there ever was before. And I'm in the middle, actually, now of reading Ian Brammer's book, A Murder in Amsterdam, which is precisely about much of this, focusing on the wonderful little country of the Netherlands.
And where the laws have changed a lot.
Yeah, where they have a lot, indeed.
So the point is, if you want a welfare state, and I have this debate with Mark Schmidt here at the New American Federation all the time, then you have to close the border. You can't have an open border system.
But there is nobody out there who wants this open border, who wants unregulated entry into the United States.
Well, actually,
I really do think the key issue. I mean, there are some business interests who do. I think if you were about to interrupt, and that may be the point you were making. But in terms of left and right, pundits and commentators and political folks. And to me, the harsher debate, the more defining debate, has been what we do about the people who are here already.
Yeah, nice try, David. The fact of the matter is that Benny Thompson, who's the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, has said flat out he's against the wall. And Hillary Clinton and Obama and Chris Dodd and Joe Biden and all the rest of them voted for amnesty earlier this year. In other words, I think obviously...
But those are two different issues. What you do with the people who are here...
If you amnesty them, if you simply give them flat amnesty...
Then
there's every incentive for the next 20 million to come too.
Well...
That was the argument, and that was the argument that prevailed... But
one could theoretically... in your framework, be in favor of tightening border security and allowing legalization.
You could. And I I'm quietly for that. I support the idea of
quietly
leaving people.
No longer. You just blew your cover
no.
blogging at TV.
No, I'm in public on that, but I would be prepared to consider lots of different approaches. And I said earlier, case-by-case basis, to go through them all. But I certainly think that the key changes that are coming are these. One, an elimination of bilingual education and bilingual public proceedings like that. Two, an elimination of anchor babies as a notion, a political notion. And three, building a wall. Now, if the Democrats, including Eliot Spitzer, want to get right on this issue and not be destroyed in the next couple of elections on this issue, then they can be for those things too. And I don't think they lose a thing in terms of authentic, small D, or for that matter, capital D, Democratic values.
I actually don't think that a lot. I think a lot of this is outside the DR framework as well. And we will see, you know, whether these fires, these burning fires, much like the fires in San Diego. I don't know. How about a wall of fire on the border? Maybe that would work down there. But we'll see whether this becomes the prairie fire that you've been talking about as long as you and I have been doing the show.
Okay.
But this is all part of an even larger Pinkertonian perspective on the world. I mean, I got my copy of the American Conservative magazine, which, if people don't know, was founded by Pat Buchanan, sort of a conservative but sort of a non-neocon, anti-neocon.
Paleocon, we call it.
Paleocon, you know, the dinosaur
conservative. Traditional.
Traditionalist.
Steeped in tradition and lore.
Yes, or one could say weighted down by old-fashioned notions no longer operative. But nevertheless,
I'll give you an old-fashioned notion.
No. Let me just tell the readers where we're leading up to, and then because I'm about to flog your piece here, and that is in the American Conservative, a piece by James P. Pinkerton, "The Once and Future Christendom,"
right,
in which you, under the influence of J.R. Tolkien, author of Lords of the Rings, write an 11-page article. We're not talking about op-ed piece here, my friends, in which you say it is time for the West to revive the notion of Christendom in terms of beating back the Islamic hordes who are about to overrun Europe, and then it's only one short hop across the puddle, and American and Western civilization is lost. You can sort of describe this yourself, but I was interested that in reading this piece, Jim, very little mention of the role that China might play in the world's future. Some people are more concerned with China being competition and perhaps problems for the West, the United States in the future. And also, in this piece, you talk very little about the flow of immigration, illegal or otherwise, from the South into the United States. You seem quite fixed, I won't say fixated, on the notion that Islam is a force that is a negative force in the world and that is really on our doorstep and about to overrun us. And unless we pull together under the banner of Christendom, not even Judeo-Christendom, we are bound to wave goodbye.
Well, I mean, obviously, I've written a great deal about immigration over the years, and so on the U.S. southern border, so obviously I feel like I've covered that. And I actually had a long cover story of the American Conservative about 2 years ago on China. But the issue at hand in terms of Europe.
That was so yesterday.
I began by asking, rhetorically, what would happen if Italy went Muslim. And now Bernard Lewis, who's a leading historian and a neocon, but still a leading historian, has said that he thinks Europe will be majority Muslim by 2100 if current demographic trends continue. And so I thought to myself, well, what would happen if the Muslims took over, say, the Vatican, and did to the Vatican what they did, that the Taliban did to those Buddhist statues in Bamiyan, Afghanistan?
But Jim, let me just stop you there, because your view of Islam here is equating all Islam to the Talibanic version of Islam.
The Wahhabi version.
Okay.
And the Wahhabis, of course.
So is it your belief that the more extreme version, the Wahhabi version, is about to take over the piazzas and Nokia factories of Italy?
I think that actually the Wahhabis are far and away the most energetic of the Sunni Muslims. They of course have the backing of the Saudi Arabian government, which is taking in $150 billion a year in oil revenues now. Steve Schwartz wrote a pretty good book a few years ago called The Two Faces of Islam, which talked a lot about Wahhabi evangelism.
Well, I understand that. I understand Wahhabism and the extremism that's inherent to it.
But the question is their iconoclastic sense of any object of religious devotion, which is what.
But you do seem to be equating all in your piece, at least equating your whole conception of Islam is Wahhabi.
Well,
yeah, Islamism.
Okay. I use that as an opening argument to say, in fact, folks, we have an obligation in our bones to defend the Vatican and the seat of Western Christendom from being destroyed or being taken over by the Muslims.
But this notion of being taken over and destroyed. This is certainly the Pinkerton nightmare scenario here. But do you really believe we're on the verge of that happening?
I think the demographic trends are pretty clear.
But you just spoke a few moments ago about the European nations taking steps
right.
to.
I'm for the steps.
Challenge
here,
those.
Here's another step that I can't.
So if they're taking those steps, is this? My concern here is that you're hyping the threat. Just the way we've seen in other instances in recent years, I'm not saying there's a challenge, and there certainly is a problem with preserving Enlightenment values in a world in which fundamentalists are opposed to them. We saw that with things like the Danish cartoons. We saw that with the fatwa against Salman Rushdie. I mean, there are aspects of Muslim culture and society that does not allow for the tolerant spoofing. Freeformism of Western, I wouldn't say Christendom, Western secularism. And maybe the divide here is not Christendom versus Islamism, but secularism versus fundamentalism.
Well,
wherever the latter may rear its ugly head.
I mean, some of the issues are pretty clear. For example, the elites of the European Union, the same people who would have been for the immigration bill here.
All these elites,
were strongly supportive of bringing Turkey into the European Union.
As is, I think, the Bush administration.
I know, which I think is crazy. And I don't think it's going to happen, because I think the Europeans have come to their senses and realized that the European Union won't be European anymore if it includes 70 million people, or whatever the population of Turkey is, who are, frankly, Asians. They're Muslims. They're Europeans. They're not Europeans. They're something else. And if Turkey...
Is it a self-fulfilling prophecy if you are out there, putting forward operating statements that are predicated on fundamental divides and believing that these fundamental divides are indeed the fundamental factors in the world at large?
Well, I think that it's pretty clear that despite the best efforts of the Western Enlightenment, that Islam is going its own way. That Samuel Huntington was a lot more right than wrong 11, 12 years ago when he wrote his, and before that when he wrote his Foreign Affairs piece, in which he said that, look, the world is dividing into separate civilizations that are separate, distinct, that are in many cases hostile to each other. And I think that's pretty, look, the evidence
isn't
from
Czechia
to the Philippines to the West Bank of Israel, inflamed cities in Paris and elsewhere in France, is pretty clear that the West and Islam are at odds with each other. They're wicked or monsters. No, they're just different. Is that what's clear is that polynational unions and organizations.
But you can't have it both ways. You can't be arguing that Islam is just fine, but it's different. What you're saying is Islam is a negative.
No, I'm
perhaps
saying
an evil force. If they want to come in and destroy the Vatican,
I'm saying no.
Isn't Turkey? Look, Turkey is an Islamic state that has a strong secular.
Yeah, and guess what direction is it headed now?
Well, with the last election,
I'll tell you why. It's heading in that direction precisely because there is a surge of nationalism, patriotism, religion, energy, whatever you want to call it. Most of it having to do with sort of reaction to the West, going through the entire Muslim world.
Maybe if the West acted differently, things would be different.
Maybe.
You think so?
It's entirely possible. But the point is, we are where we are right now. And in places like Egypt, I mean, a friend of mine was in Egypt a few years ago. She's been to Egypt many times. And she said, look, 30 years ago to Egypt, they were wearing skirts. Now, the women in the protests, the pro-Islamic protests in Cairo, are not only veiled, they're wearing gloves. And this is a hot country.
After we've supported, a virtual, dictator there for all these years, just the way we did in Iran as well, which was a secular state until we came along and, put the Shah in and supported him and did nothing except, fuel the fires of fundamentalism.
In my piece, I argue that the much sounder strategy, the Christendom strategy, if you will, is to simply say, look, this is ours, and we're going to defend it, and that's yours, and you can have it.
What would you say to American Muslims?
I would say.
What would you say? Do they have to? That you're living in a Christendom state, and if you don't like it, you can leave it.
I would say this is a Western state, and we are not establishing a religion. Repeat, not. But
we're just calling ourselves Christendom.
We are going to be, the Christendom thing is based on a different argument, which is the observation that of the 2.2 billion people in the world who are mostly Christian, the historically Christian places, they're actually, curiously enough, divided into four.
Okay, but wait, I don't want you to get off so easy on the American Muslim question. I interrupted you, my fault. Please go back to
the
message you would say to them.
Say
or to
out,
Hindus, or to Zen.
We Americans understand we have a serious, and I do underline serious, internal security problem. And just as...
What's your evidence of that?
Pardon?
What's your evidence of that?
9/11?
No, our internal security problem.
Well, 9/11 was here in New York.
Yes, but since then, all these terrorism cases have gone nowhere.
No, the London case, case.
But none of these people were Americans.
Okay,
I'm talking about American
that,
Muslims.
That,
you know,
David,
what do you say to American Muslims?
David, it is naive to think that the same intellectual, ideological, jihadist currents that are propagated on channels like Al Jazeera and through the web aren't rattling around in the Muslim communities here in America. That's just naive.
Well, what's your evidence?
Well, the evidence is they keep busting these conspiracies that fortunately never get very far. The Lackawanna case, the Lodi, California case.
The Lackawanna, even the prosecutor there said it was a minor case.
Minor isn't non-existent.
Listen, the Fort Dix case. I mean, we have 300 million people in this country. There are idiots out there, doing stupid things all the time. Should we be vigilant and follow up? Yes. But to say there's an internal security problem, that seems to me, to get close to McCarthy-like terms.
Well, you can say it that way. I would just prefer to call it internal security. I prefer to say that as in World War I, when we looked at the population of German Americans and said, we got to watch you guys closely because we're about to go to war with your mother country.
And you know where I'm going to go with this right now. What's the obvious retort to you, Jim?
I don't know, David.
Japanese detention camps.
Okay.
Was that a good move, FDR?
Detention is too strong, but surveillance is a good idea. And so you asked me what I do about American Muslims. The answer is I put a cop in front of every mosque until I was completely satisfied.
You put a cop in front of every mosque?
That's what I said. And I'll tell you what, we can have some elections on this issue. We can have some votes. Whether we should have a vigorous, rigorous internal security program and...
I mean, do you have any proof that every mosque deserves a cop in front of it?
I would put one in there just for safekeeping all the way around. I just think it's a, it'll just be. I mean, by the way, I think that's sort of happening.
And what would
now,
that
anyway.
Cop? What would that cop do? Take down license plate
just,
numbers?
Just
look cross-eyed at people going in?
I
mean, you know, maybe search them. Maybe you know, get into their computers. I mean, what would that
would
cop
good,
do in front of that monster? Come on.
It would be a good Durkheimian.
Talk to me in practical terms.
It would be a good Durkheimian exercise.
A what exercise?
Durkheimian.
Durkheimian.
As Emile Durkheim, the famous French sociologist, who...
Excuse me for my ignorance
at
this point.
Who preached, that said that, that norm setting is very valuable, and that civilizations exist according... when they and survive, and cultures and societies only survive as long as they have common values and common understandings.
Now, but acting like a police state doesn't make you a police state, right?
No, acting like a democracy determined to defend itself is what makes you a long-lived society.
If you identify threats correctly and deploy your resources appropriately.
Right.
I mean, you know what? This isn't what I like to have an election based on. Let's go with a Pinkerton plan. We'll put a cop in front of every mosque.
Okay.
We'll pull them out of other places because we can't afford it.
People
won't pay taxes.
We'll hire more if we need to. This is a rich country. But here's the...
Fine, okay, you can tax the wealth for that. But even so, the first time that, you know, that a kid is kidnapped down the block because a cop is just sitting there in front of a mosque, let's have an election on that
okay.
as well.
David,
okay,
David, I'll have... You know me. I'll have lots of cops. I'm a Republican. I'll pay any amount of money for adequate security and Homeland Security.
Okay. Well, you tell when you pass your bill through Congress, you know, raising taxes, you know, on wealthy Americans to pay for these cops. Then we can talk about where they're deployed.
I do it in a heartbeat. You know me.
Okay.
The point here, the reason I wrote the piece in the September 10th issue of the American.
Hey Jim, why don't you just start right now and take up a private collection and hire a private cop to get in front of as many mosques as you can. You know, this could be let the people speak. We don't have to do this through government. We can do this. We can privatize this. Blackwater, there you go. I'm sure you can hire Blackwater guards just to walk back and forth in front of a mosque. It's a sidewalk. You can't stop people from walking back and forth. Anything wrong with that plan?
I think that you are just... For reasons unbeknownst to me, attempting to coin a phrase, McCarthyize, a legitimate concern about, look, we're in a war, David. You and I opposed it, but we're in it now, and as Huntington would say, as history tells us, this war is nowhere near over. Another terrorist attack is coming, and we should be prepared for it. But my point was...
Of course we should. We should be prepared, and we should... I'm second to no one in my concern about Islamic fundamentalism. I am coming to you from Capitol Hill, half a block away from the U.S. Capitol, which was probably the target of the fourth plane. I take this stuff very seriously. Anyone living in Washington ought to have their head examined, but you also worry about what's going to happen. So, it's not an issue of caring and,
okay.
and recognizing
and
that there's a threat and a problem.
I'm prepared to take more steps, maybe than you are,
I would say
in order
different
to
steps.
Secure this, which is ours.
I would say different steps. But perhaps we should. I don't think you're going to convince me, and I'm certainly not going to persuade you and make you change your faith on
okay.
this matter. but I tell you, as a person who is Jewish in culture, if not fully in belief, you know, to see on the cover of the American Conservative, you know, save in a headline that says something like, you know, saving Christendom. It seems a little exclusionary.
Those who read the piece will see that
I know that's not you, Jim. You are not exclusionary.
Specifically, in case anybody's wondering, I think as a Bible-reading Christian, I thought to myself, well, gee whiz, if I don't want to see the Vatican destroyed, I also don't want to see Jerusalem destroyed.
No. You're very good in including the Jews of Israel in your Christendom and walling everybody off against the Islamic hordes.
And saying, just in case people are wondering,
why not just the West?
Once the West is allied in a strong position.
It's the religiosity here. You know, saying Christendom does exclude people who adhere to Western values of tolerance, who may even practice Muslim, Islamic religion.
It doesn't exclude anybody. It just only takes note of that which unites 90% of the people who live in those four areas.
I'm talking about the other 10%,
okay.
perhaps.
Well,
your piece does not say cut these people out, deport them unless they're here illegally. You don't say that. I'm just saying as a point of rhetoric.
Well, the reason why the rhetoric is valuable, the reason I put it in there, was as a rallying cry to remind people, and to remind people who otherwise, I think, are eager to see the West destroyed, like Putin and like Hugo Chavez, that in fact they have a stake in the preservation of the Western Christian corpus.
Well, it seems, and it seems to me...
The reason is being this, and that is that right at any given moment, Putin and Hugo Chavez, and probably Castro and others, are busy rooting for the Iranians, and right. hoping that Iran gets a nuclear weapon so that it can nuke New York or Tel Aviv.
Well, but it does seem to me that, particularly, you know this from being involved in politics, Jim, that people know what their own interests are. And to go around saying, Putin or Chavez or anybody else, no. You see that, what you think is really wrong, and you should join us in this, Christendom, crusade or, preservation, is politically naive.
Well, here's why it would work, I think. And that is, right now, if the issue is getting Putin and Chavez and Castro and whoever else, for that matter, a lot of leftists in the West, to help Bush and America occupy Iraq or subdue Iran, of course their answer is no. They don't want
right.
us to. They don't want us to do it. They don't want us to succeed.
So you say,
look, the secret about Russia and Venezuela is that the underlying religious historical commonality is still there. Hugo Chavez, much to the consternation of leftists, is pro-life. Venezuela is a pro-life, anti-abortion country. Why?
It's a Catholic nation.
I'm sorry?
It's a lot of Catholics.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So
much of Latimer.
There is that underlying subtext of a religious common ground to take advantage of.
I'll make this last point before we move on if you want to keep going. It seems to me, though, Jim, that after 9/11, we had the opportunity, the historic opportunity, of making this an issue of the West versus Islamic fundamentalism, extremism, jihadism. And we completely blew it by, as you agree, blundering into Iraq. And now, though, it seems like you want to up the ante by making this, the clash of religions rather than the description of what I said.
No, I want to down the ante. That's the whole point. What the neocons want,
talking about Christendom versus Islamism, is about
wants is to sort of stay in Iraq and continue to supervise them. And I say no.
But your overarching concept here, is Christendom versus the Islamic world, all of it, not just the fundamentalists, but everybody. Indonesia, the people in Detroit. And that seems to me to be, biting off a lot.
It's not biting off anything if you simply say we're going to defend this. What I don't want to attack. I don't want to run their countries for them. I don't want to make them Democrats. They can do what they want. I do want to, I do want to say this about China. I do want to ally with other countries that are also interested in preserving their sphere of influence. I want the Chinese to be the right. dominant power in Asia. That's fine with me. I want the Indians to be the dominant power in South Asia. That's fine. And if we do that, then we will find ourselves in a natural alliance of status quo-minded powers against those who seek to upend the status quo. And that's most obviously the Islamic world, which is as political science would say, is revisionist.
Well, I still think you have a rhetorical overplay, nothing else. And speaking of rhetorical overplaying, there's one thing that ticks me off. You want to know what it is?
Go ahead.
I'm glad you asked. General Manager Dan O'Dowd of the Colorado Rockies, who are who made it after 15 years to the World Series in Major League Baseball, told USA Today recently, "You look at some of the moves we made and didn't make. You look at some of the games we're winning. Those aren't just a coincidence. God has definitely had a hand in this." And so God doesn't like the Yankees. God made the New York Mets lose. I mean, we have some real major messes in this world, as you obsess and write about all the time. And rather than worrying about preserving Christendom versus the Islamic world, or perhaps if God is a Muslim, having the Islamic world overrun the Christendom world, God is worrying about balls and strikes in baseball stadiums in the United States. The story of the Colorado Rockies And this comes, you know, every once in a while there's a team that comes along that has a religious nature to it. Joe Gibbs of the Washington Redskins, coaching now, back in the 80s, you know, had prayer sessions with right-wing religious leaders for his team. There are lots of, you know, holy rollers on the Colorado Rockies. I pray for them if they really believe that their wonderful triumphs on the sporting field have anything to do with divine intervention. I mean, what hubris, what arrogance. I say that too about rappers and rock stars when they come up and they get Grammy Awards and they, you know, thank God for making this happen. God, she has to be a lot busier than this.
What did you say there? Did you say she?
I said she.
Okay,
whatever.
You're kind of putting your cards on the table there, huh?
All I know in my house, it's a she.
Well, because I do believe, contrary to what you think, I do believe in freedom and religious freedom and the freedom to have faith or no faith. I defend to the death your right to have those views. I frankly think it's sort of more amusing just how much atheists and agnostics and however else people describe themselves sort of sputter and splutter at what the Colorado Rockies have done. I mean, I'm not much of a baseball fan, frankly, but when I read that they won 21 out of 22 games to finish up the season, that was pretty good. You know.
It was great, but let me ask you this, Jim, a smart guy like you. Do you believe God had anything to do with that?
I don't know.
If you believe in God.
I don't know. I do believe this, though, and I'm going to say it as straight as I can. If God wanted to, he could make all their strikes, and all their opponents into foul balls and strikeouts.
Well, I would hope so. Otherwise, what good is God? Well,
so, in other words, I don't know. I do believe in the power of prayer, and I do believe it makes a difference. And I,
because God listens and intercedes?
I believe God listens and intercedes, if he wants to. And I mean, look, the hardest thing in the world, and something I never try to do...
What makes him decide whether to get involved in the sporting event or not?
No idea.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not God. But what's sort of amusing to me, and another reminder of the cleft between the elites and, and sort of the masses, is that I think that most Americans saying, gee, the Colorado Rockies pray, and they cross themselves when they go to the pitcher's mound and so on, or some of them do at least, I think most Americans think that's pretty good. And yet the Washington Post finds it kind of vaguely outrageous and subversive and weird, and the National Football League, the Major League Baseball, not football, had a quote from one of the Rocky players talking about this, and they edited it out because they just simply don't think that's appropriate.
Well, no. They claim it was for, you know, space reasons. I don't know. I mean, we don't know. But listen, I agree with you there. I mean, whatever the guy says, you know, no matter how idiotic I may think it is, I mean, I believe, you know, he has a right to, you know, to speak. And it shouldn't have been edited out for editorial reasons. And, you know, there have been other baseball players. You know, the San Diego Padres were known for their religiosity back in the, I believe it was back in the 80s, if I can remember that far back. To put forward the idea that you know where God is intervening and not...
David, I really don't think that, upon close inspection, I really doubt that's what he was saying. I really suspect he was saying...
God has definitely had a hand in this.
Remember, some people believe that God is intervening in everything and constantly in doing so. And I don't happen to believe that. I my argument is he could if he wanted to. And that is it's a slight distinction. So, but I think what's more interesting is, I mean, John Gray, who's a well-known political scientist at Oxford, in England, wrote a book recently called Black Mass, which is sort of his attack effectively on the Christopher Hitchens of the world, in which he said that, you know, look, the anti-religion has become its own kind of religion. And I sort of thought of that book and John Gray when I read the article, the articles plural about the Rockies and how much attention this is getting, because the secular world just can't imagine.
Well, wait a second. You know, as someone who is agnostic on a good day, this world of ours, well, I mean, the United States, that is, you know, the people who believe in religion, who believe in God, have the upper hand, you know, routinely. And, you know, it's only in the last year or two that people who identify themselves as atheists and are challenging, you know, this, the book, The God Delusion, and Sam Harris's book, as well as Christopher Hitchens, you know, are getting, a fraction of the attention that church and God get in this nation.
Well,
so,
I mean, there's been no
advantage to being agnostic or atheist, in decades here. Politicians are forced to say God bless you, which is something that even Dwight Eisenhower didn't use in his speeches. I mean, the advantage is not to the skeptics and those who raise the questions. And it seems to me that after a couple thousand years of Christianity or any other religion, and looking around at the world as it is today, I would say this for Islam too, one would have a pretty, there's a good case to be made that all these guiding forces in our cultures and civilizations are to be put under scrutiny. And if they can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen,
I would just make this distinction, and that is, obviously, the vast majority of the American people are religious in some degree or another.
Yes.
Okay. It is equally obvious that somebody who's lived in university towns for literally all my life, or big cities all my life, that among the elites, if you're a Christian, you are oftentimes well advised to keep it quiet. And the level of skepticism and mockery in Hollywood, on television, is less than it used to be. Because finally Hollywood has sort of woken up to, the phenomenon that Christians actually are starting to pay attention to what's being said about them, and they notice it. So now there is a kind of
You say this about elites. When have presidential candidates and presidents, knocked on the churches?
Elites, presidential candidates have to get votes from real people.
What elites are you talking about?
The media and the world of foundations and think tanks, which you and I are both very familiar with. There's not much discussion and consideration of any religious theme to speak of.
My office is in the Methodist building. I'm surrounded by public interest people here who are motivated and are working out of religious conviction.
I didn't say there weren't lots of them. I was saying that it'd be very hard to find a discussion, until recently, a fair discussion of Christianity in the major media. They get pounded all the time. The presumption was that at best Jesus was a fake, and of course his believers are sort of misguided people who eventually be talked out of their silly beliefs.
I defy you to show me in the mainstream media where that is the explicit theme of the day.
It's every edition of the New York Times.
All the religious coverage they have?
Time Magazine.
What are you talking about?
Religious born-again Christians are stupid, whatever it was that Michael Weisskopf said at that time,
So you have one example from about 12 years ago.
It is over and over again. There's sort of a smug presumption. Look, there's a reason why...
Well, if they're represented by people like Pat Robertson, there's a good reason to look at that constituency.
Okay. Take an example.
Pat Robertson, he literally wrote a book, The New World Order. Go read it if you haven't. He calls George W. Bush a tool of Satan. a tool of Satan.
I think that's...
So I look at that and I say, guy's a nut. People who believe him, they believe in a nut.
Robertson's a nut. How about that?
Okay, very good. Okay, what about people who give money to him and buy his swill?
They could spend their money better elsewhere.
Are they misguided?
If they give money to Robertson, yes.
Are they intelligent people? Are they looking critically at the issues and making informed decisions?
They might be intelligent, but it's not intelligent to give too much money to Pat Robertson.
Okay.
Robertson is a hard case to defend.
Why do you think I chose him?
It's like me going to you and saying, hey, David, defend Stalin. I mean, come on. It's... You there?
I'm here.
Okay, all right, good. I think that the
I never worked for anybody who sought the support of Joe Stalin. Well, in fact, you did in terms of Pat Robertson.
Sought the support of Stalin.
No, sought the support of Pat Robertson. No, I said I never worked for anybody who ever went out looking for Joe Stalin's support. Well, you worked for people who are quite happy to find the support of Pat Robertson and his misguided followers.
When did I work for somebody who wanted Pat Robertson's support?
George H.W. Bush.
We ran against him in '88.
After the primaries, yes, and then he didn't want his support in '92.
Oh, I don't know. Probably. I'm sure
well,
we did.
Of course. You
know.
Yeah. Okay.
Look, politics. There's a reason why I'm not in politics anymore.
That's why I like talking to you these days. That's why I like talking to you these days.
Because I want the freedom to think exactly what I want to think and say what exactly I want to say. And so it's a lot. You pay a price for it, as you and I both had learned.
Yeah.
You don't initially have everybody as your friend, and so on. But anyway, just go back to the Rockies. I sort of found myself. I was actually born in Massachusetts, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and so I should be a Red Sox.
God, what happened, Jim? How far you've come. The town elders must be pulling out their hair. But so are you rooting for the Rockies is what I want to know, though you come from Cambridge, Massachusetts, close to the great Green Monster.
It would be sort of insincere for me to say that I was any kind of sports fan. But I found myself charmed by the Rockies, and if they do, so I guess in some sense, yes, I am rooting for them.
This is the question.
I really care either way.
Okay.
But I will look forward to the Blogging Heads session after the World Series, where one of us will.
Well, I'm not. I don't know if I'm rooting for or against anyone this year, but I do have one question. And that is, if the Rockies lose, will they blame God? give them credit. You got to give them blame.
I think that just for the theological point here, it's not so much.
God's
whether,
on your side when you do well, but when you screw up.
No, I think you just simply say thank you, God, when you're better off, and you say it's God's will when you're worse off. That's reasonable.
Okay, God is great.
I'm going to tell Christopher since you said that.
Very good. Well, I'll see you at the ballpark, and I'll see you later on Blogging Heads TV.
Thank you, David.